Crime bosses in the US, Europe, and Australia thought they were using a new app to chat privately.
Eventually, hundreds of criminal organizations were using this platform.
Turns out the app was a sting set up by the FBI and international partners. Also today, questioning the health of Canadian multiculturalism, and we look at the world of palm oil. It is everywhere these days.
It's very cheap to produce, and also it's super versatile.
But production is destroying critical rainforests. I'm Marco Werman, and today is World Oceans Day. A Cuban singer pays tribute to the seas.
I felt very inspired to be the voice of the ocean because I asked myself this question: if the sea could send a message to humanity, what would it be?
Channeling the ocean, all of that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Thank you for being with us. Law enforcement officials from more than a dozen countries are claiming a big victory today and pulling back the curtain on how they did it. According to authorities in the US, Australia, and Europe, suspected criminals were drawn in using a smartphone app managed by the FBI. The operation was codenamed Trojan Shield. Officials say it dealt a serious blow to criminal gangs around the globe, but the scheme also raises questions about how law enforcement carries out electronic surveillance. The World's Lydia Manalidou begins our coverage.
If you want to communicate privately with someone, you might use an app like Signal or Telegram. It's difficult, even for law enforcement agencies, to monitor communications on these apps.
These platforms help criminals facilitate and coordinate drug trafficking, violent assaults, murders, and many other crimes that are committed all around the world.
That's Calvin Shivers with the FBI's Criminal Investigative Division speaking at a press conference earlier today, describing an international sting operation.
Through Operation Trojan Shield, the FBI and our international law enforcement partners from across the globe were able to turn the tables on criminal organizations and gain access to their communications in order to disrupt their criminal activity.
Here's what the FBI did. Instead of trying to monitor encrypted smartphone apps, they started their own in 2018, called Anom. FBI agents had informants distribute devices loaded with the app to unwitting suspected criminals who thought they were getting top-notch security. At first, the FBI worked with its equivalent in Australia, the Australian Federal Police, to test out Anom there. Commissioner Rhys Kershaw said today this gave law enforcement unprecedented access to criminal communications.
Essentially, we have been in the back pockets of organized crime.
That's allowed them to see alleged drug traffickers and suspected Australian mafia members communicate in real time about all kinds of stuff.
Drugs, violence, hits on each other, innocent people who are going to be murdered. It would be like, I need 1,000 kilos at this price.
Authorities in Australia say they were able to use this information to arrest some of the country's most dangerous criminals, to get drugs and guns off the streets. And they say they even prevented a mass shooting from taking place. Meanwhile, global law enforcement authorities were cracking down on other encrypted platforms popular with organized crime groups. And that drove more and more of them to Anom.
Eventually, hundreds of criminal organizations were using this platform. It has a good reputation among criminals.
Janine van der Berg is a chief at the Central Police Unit in the Netherlands, one of the countries that took part in Operation Trojan Shield. Authorities across Europe, the US, Australia, and elsewhere say they watched as crime gangs in Italy, South American drug cartels, and other groups used the FBI's app to communicate. Jean-Philippe Lecouf with Europol, the EU's law enforcement agency, said the scale of the operation is unprecedented.
The figures are impressive. More than 27 million messages obtained and reviewed over 18 months.
Lecouf says they've been monitoring criminal syndicates in more than 100 countries. All in all, officials say the operation has led to hundreds of arrests, tens of millions of dollars in asset seizures, and even uncovered high-level public corruption cases in several countries. Officials say they're going public with Anom right now because there was a legal time frame for the operation. And they hope this undermines the confidence of anyone trying to use encrypted apps for illegal activities.
But you know, this isn't over.
Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison said today that coordinated crackdowns like these will continue. The FBI is sending the same message, saying this is just the beginning. For The World, I'm Lydia Emanuelidou.
As we just heard, this global sting used an encrypted device network called Anom. This sort of operation could also have implications for any citizen who uses encrypted messaging apps. To help us understand the broader conversation about encryption, we've turned to John Scott Railton. He's a senior researcher at the Citizen Lab at the University of Toronto's Monk School. John, what first struck you when you learned about how this global sting actually operated?
Well, it's a remarkable caper. 11 or 12,000 criminals using an encrypted app that was basically backdoored since the beginning. It's kind of a remarkable law enforcement achievement, but it also raises a lot of questions. And some of those questions have to do with privacy and encryption for the rest of us.
So start with the question about privacy. What should we be asking in regards to this operation as far as privacy goes?
For years, the Justice Department and every other law enforcement branch all around the world have been telling us that criminals are going dark, that they don't have access to encrypted communications, and as a result, they need to break the encryption of popular chat and communications apps like WhatsApp, iMessage, and Signal in order to listen to what criminals are doing. What this case shows is that global law enforcement is perfectly capable of mobilizing a multi-year caper to get around exactly the kinds of problems about encryption that they've been talking about without breaking the encryption of the apps that keep you and I private.
So the authorities clearly rounded up a lot of bad people in this operation. At the same time, on some kind of gut level, the whole thing sounds kind of, for lack of a better word, creepy, right?
Well, it does sound creepy. And I think the way that we should think about this, according to the Justice Department, all of the people who use this were criminals. The message I think to take away, though, is, okay, this shows what happens when law enforcement gains access to a so-called encrypted chat tool, which is they use it and they will use it profligately. Now, people are going to say, well, okay, look, criminals doing criminal business, tricked by criminal influencers into using backdoored phones, this doesn't sound like it's a net bad for society. In fact, right, this is thousands of tons of cocaine intercepted, criminals put in jail, murder plots disrupted. Whatever your views about encryption, it's hard not to see that as a kind of a win for law enforcement. But the really big question here remains, which is, what happens next? Criminals are not going to trust, presumably, the next bespoke encryption app that is pitched to them. They may try to use the same apps that you or I use. Are we going to see an even greater law enforcement push now to gain access to our private communications in order to chase these criminals to where they go next?
How do you think governments or others might lean into this experience with this clever scheme and technology for mass surveillance?
Students of history will remember that there is a Swiss company called Crypto AG that for decades sold allegedly encrypted communications tools to the embassies of hundreds of countries around the world. As we learned recently, all of that encryption was backdoored and the data was secretly flowing back to the US intelligence community, the CIA and the NSA. It shows that law enforcement has, understandably, an endless appetite to gain access to private and encrypted communications. The issue, as we all understand now, is that you and I like the feeling of being able to communicate securely and privately, especially in the context of the pandemic, with our loved ones, with our friends, with our colleagues. Where we don't want to be is a situation where law enforcement tells us, you know what, the only way we can protect you is to have the ability to listen to whatever anyone says on the device you use. And I'm just very concerned that this battle between privacy advocates and civil liberties advocates and governments is not over. And I think this latest case just shows us that when, for years, the government has said, we don't have access to encrypted communications that criminals are using anymore, that they were speaking out of one side of their mouth because they knew that, in fact, thousands of criminals were using platforms that they were monitoring right down to the last bit.
John Scott Railton is a senior researcher at the Monk School Citizen Lab at the University of Toronto. He's been speaking with us about the broader implications of a massive global crime sting using an encrypted messaging app. John, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks so much.
Canada is grappling with a deadly and horrific attack on a Muslim family. In the city of London, Ontario, yesterday, a man deliberately drove his truck up onto the curb, ramming into a family out for a walk. Four people were killed. One is in the hospital. Police said the attacker deliberately targeted the family because they were Muslim. Canada has witnessed a rise in attacks against Muslims in recent years. To talk about this, we're turning to Yusuf Fakiri. He's the Quebec Director for Public Affairs at the National Council of Canadian Muslims. Yusuf, what was your initial reaction when you heard about this tragic news from London, Ontario?
Thank you for having me, Marco. It's a difficult time. It was sadness, anger, heartache, shock, and bewilderment how we're in this situation right at it again, sir. More than 4.5 years after the tragedy that took place in the Centre Culturel Islamique du Québec in January 2017.
And remind us briefly what happened there.
In January 29, 2017, six Muslims were violently murdered by a terrorist act committed by Alexandre Bissonnette in the place of worship. And we thought that never again. But it wasn't just Quebec, Marco. I deal with stuff in Quebec for the council. But, you know, last year there was a man from our community in Toronto that was murdered in front of a mosque in Toronto. There was a shooting in Montreal in April where somebody shot the mosque 11 times. There's been attacks on members of the Muslim community in Calgary and Edmonton the last couple months. It continues, and this tragedy with four members of a family perished hits home quite hard today.
Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has expressed anger. He said it was a terrorist attack motivated by racism. What should do you think the Canadian government be doing to combat this?
They need to work with our partners. The Canadian government did something important earlier this year when they announced, when they recognized that January 29th, the National Day of Action Against Hate and Islamophobia. But we need a national strategy on Islamophobia, Marco, across the nation, across the provinces, at the political and federal level. People need to call this for what it is. You know, there's certain provinces where our own, the premiers deny Islamophobia exists. That in itself is a problem, Marco. And I want to be clear here, sir. This fight against Islamophobia is related to anti-Semitism. We need, and against anti-Sikhism, anti-Asian, you know, the anti-racism against Asian Canadians, and that we need a collective effort. This should not just fall on the Muslim community.
So if we are to get to the root of this hate, what do you think is behind this rise in Islamophobia and violence that we've been witnessing in Canada?
There's a direct link with all the terrorist acts that were committed, you know, the last few years by white supremacists. Right. If you look at Alexandre Bissonnette or the tragedy that felt Mr. Zafis in Toronto or, you know, that happened, you know, even now, as you know, the London police have called this a hate motivated crime. There has to be understood there's this notion of a direct link nexus between white supremacy and Islamophobia.
Canada, as you know, prides itself on being a multicultural society. I mean, that's also the reputation it seems to have globally. But is there something going on beneath the surface? What do we not understand about Canada?
We have to understand that there's a fundamental problem going on with this nexus of white supremacy and Islamophobia. And we have to work together collectively to dismantling it. And this is very important. And one of the issues that often happens, Marco, is that there's a discourse at certain political levels that sometimes adds to these notions of Islamophobia. And I mentioned that earlier in our conversation.
Do you think Justin Trudeau's government is doing enough? Are they calling out leaders who deny Islamophobia?
Well, I will say this, Marco, is that more work has to be done on all political levels. And I believe that our work is far from over, sir. I will say that.
As you said, you're heading to London for the vigil. What words, what advice do you have, Yusuf, for Canadian Muslims who want to move forward after these events?
We wanted to say never again, but we want to say that we stand with you. And we'll continue to work with you, and that we're here for you, and we'll continue to fight with you side by side in building that inclusive society that's tempered with justice.
Yusuf Fakiri is the Quebec Director for Public Affairs at the National Council of Canadian Muslims. Yusuf, thank you very much. My condolences to you.
Thank you very much, Marco, for your time, sir.
We'll be right back. You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman. You're with the world. Look at the fine print of many processed foods and beauty products. There's a strong chance you'll see palm oil among the ingredients. Palm oil production has nearly doubled worldwide over the past decade. It's transformed economies, landscapes, and our bodies. It's a focus of the new book, Planet Palm, How Palm Oil Ended Up in Everything and Endangered the World. Author Jocelyn Zuckerman is here to discuss all things palm oil. So palm oil is found in a lot of stuff today, Jocelyn. What exactly is palm oil and why has it become so popular?
So it comes from a plant that's native to West and Central Africa. These days, though, the industry is centered in Southeast Asia. It's very cheap to produce, and also it's super versatile. It's just a cheap filler that companies can use to put in all these products. It helps with sort of the texture of the product, and it also helps it become more shelf stable so that the product can last longer without getting stale.
So I said that palm oil production has nearly doubled worldwide over the past decade. How far back does palm oil go in our food systems?
So far back. It was very important to the cuisine and the culture of communities in West Africa and Central Africa. But beginning in the 1700s, Europeans began sourcing palm oil from Africa to use for lighting their lanterns and then eventually for soaps and candles and eventually margarines.
So with this recent boom in palm oil cultivation consumption, what's driving that? Is it driven by food makers or government policies or both?
In the early 2000s, the Food and Drug Administration determined that trans fats were bad for us. And then they deemed that you had to take trans fats out altogether. So palm oil was used to replace those oils that had been hydrogenated. So imports went up for that reason. And then in 2007, George Bush introduced a biofuels mandate that had a similar effect. So the domestic soy and corn oils that were going to biofuels were no longer going to food production. And so we needed other oil to put in those foods. So that also meant more palm oil imports coming into this country.
So as the shift has moved to the Far East, places like Indonesia and Malaysia, what's been the consequence of this massive increase in palm oil cultivation in those countries?
The main problem with palm oil is that it grows best at 10 degrees to the north and south of the equator, which is a swath of land that corresponds with our tropical rainforest. And as I'm sure your listeners know, these ecosystems are hugely important for sequestering carbon. They also support more than half the world's plant and animal species, including the world's great apes. And then the other big issue is that a lot of the tropical rainforests sit on top of peatlands, which are soils that have formed over thousands of years through the accumulation of organic matter. And these are sort of waterlogged terrain. And in order to plant oil palm or anything else, I imagine, you have to sort of drain this land and then the plantation companies burn it. And when you do that, you're releasing massive amounts of carbon into the atmosphere. In 2015 and then in 2019, people might remember there were these massive fires in Indonesia. The haze was going all the way over across into Singapore and Thailand.
Right.
They were set those fires to clear the land largely for oil palm. There was a study afterward. They found that it led to the premature deaths of 100,000 people.
I'm speaking with Jocelyn Zuckerman. She's the author of Planet Palm, How Palm Oil Ended Up in Everything and Endangered the World. In addition to the environmental destruction in places like Malaysia and Indonesia, what are the labor conditions like for people who work on these palm plantations?
They're pretty rough. So in Malaysia, for example, so Malaysia has a much smaller population than Indonesia, and it also has a much higher standard of living. So the country relies on over 335,000 migrant workers, mostly from India, Bangladesh, Myanmar, and also Indonesia. A lot of these folks are brought there under false pretenses. Recruiters go to villages in these places and tell them, we're going to get you jobs in restaurants and hotels. Then they put them on boats, horrific conditions. And then they get to Thailand or Malaysia and put them in these camps and then traffic them to these plantations, wow. Often take their passports away. Many have had to escape sort of under cover of night. In Indonesia, there's been widely documented evidence of child labor. So the plantations often work with quota systems. So it's like you have to bring in this amount of fruit by the end of the day, and it's a lot of fruit. So like the man who's maybe has a temporary contract with the plantation will often bring his wife and his children to the field with him to collect the fruits so that he can meet that quota. And yet they're not compensated for their work at all.
Then there's the health aspect. I mean, as consumers, we're obviously eating more palm oil now than ever. What impact is this having on our bodies?
Worldwide, there's just way more vegetable oil in our diet. We tend to blame sugar for the obesity problems that are spreading across the world. But in fact, refined vegetable oils have added far more calories to the global diet in the last 50 years than any other food group, including sugar and other sweeteners. We're just getting a lot more oil in our diet than we need.
What advice do you have for people who want to avoid palm oil? I mean, should we be checking out those really tiny font ingredient lists at grocery stores?
It's a little tricky because it goes under all these different names. I mean, there are a lot of things you could see and not even realize that that's connected to palm oil. So things like stearic acid, palmitic acid, sodium lauryl sulfate, those are all derivatives of the oil palm fruit.
Really?
So I guess I would say, you know, look at labels, cut out ultra-processed foods, and, you know, go on the websites of the companies. PepsiCo uses a lot, Unilever, Colgate Palmolive. Call them on it. Tell them, you know, that you want to know where they're sourcing their palm oil, if it's linked to deforestation, human rights abuses, labor abuses. Consumers should let the companies know that we care about it. A lot of it happens in such remote areas. In the book, I talk about traveling to Liberia and Sumatra and sort of landing in the capitals of these places and then getting in a four-wheel drive and driving for 8 hours or so on really rough roads. So a lot of why the industry can get away with this stuff is because it's so far away and there's sort of maybe not journalists or other watchdog groups on the ground tracking it.
Can you envision a day when the U.S. will pass some kind of policy on palm oil?
Actually, Senator Brian Schatz, Democrat from Hawaii, he recently announced, it's not specific to palm oil, but he announced plans to introduce legislation that would put in place import requirements for agricultural commodities associated with illegal deforestation. And when he announced it, he said specifically, I don't think most Americans realize that palm oil is in like half of the things in grocery stores. Britain and the EU are in the process of developing similar regulatory measures.
Jocelyn Zuckerman is the author of Planet Palm, How Palm Oil Ended Up in Everything and Endangered the World. Jocelyn, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thanks so much, Marco.
We know what many of you love, the music you hear on the show, new artists you may not have known about but do now, or the stories behind their sounds. In our series called Movement, we've been telling stories of global migration through music. Check out our profiles of artists with feet in the U.S. and roots in Ethiopia, Mexico, Iran, Sudan. And to go with the stories, there is a Spotify playlist for you to enjoy. You can find it all at theworld.org/movement. You're listening to The World. The Israeli government is being accused of apartheid. Many Israelis from South Africa find that offensive and say their adopted home is nothing like where they came from.
No free press, no free thought, a risk without trial. A system that is so horrible that I can't even begin to see the comparison.
But many in South Africa do see the comparison. That's coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. It's been more than 2 weeks now since a ceasefire was struck between Israel and Hamas. In Gaza, where Hamas is in power, hospitals and health facilities are continuing to struggle. The strip of land that's home to 2 million people remains under a blockade imposed by Israel and Egypt, and getting medicine and supplies into Gaza remains difficult. Dr. Nidal Abu Hadrous is head of the neurosurgery department at the European Hospital in Gaza. Dr. Abu Hadrous, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
What was the situation like at the hospital where you work, doctor? What did you witness during those weeks of fighting?
To start with, in the health sector in Gaza Strip, even before the last attack, was extremely difficult. Gaza Strip is under blockade for more than 15 years, and we have a shortage in so many equipment, spare parts, and supplies, medical supplies. So we were already in difficult situation. And during the last attack, this situation further deteriorated. So dealing with so many patients, with limited resources, with limited staff, with risky to move to the hospital and to come back from the hospital. So you can imagine how difficult the situation.
For you as a neurosurgeon, I mean, you're working on the brain. What was it like to work under these conditions?
Yes, it's difficult. So many brain injuries. But unfortunately, you know, brain injuries were very severe. So most of the patients who received head injury, the minority reached the hospital alive, and some cases were operated. But the majority with these significant injuries were killed, unfortunately, even before reaching the hospital.
Dr. Abu Hadrous, can you just describe Gaza's medical infrastructure for us? I know the system has been on the brink of collapse for a long time. Where does the medical system in Gaza stand today?
Oh, far away from where it should be. We suffered from 3 to 4 wars or attacks like the last one over the last decade. This exhausted our resources, our health system struggling actually, and with difficulty we are covering the emergency conditions. So many cases, there is no resources to deal with. So we are trying to send them abroad outside Gaza, which is also very difficult. So there are people who died because they couldn't get the needed treatment.
I want to just make note of your colleagues who were killed in the fighting between Israel and Hamas, including the most prominent doctor in Gaza who's been working on the COVID task force. His home was actually destroyed in the fighting as well. Where would you say that leaves Gaza's COVID patients and just the overall effort to protect people in Gaza from the pandemic?
Yeah, Dr. Ayman, you mentioned he's our colleague, our friend, and unfortunately, he was killed in the middle of the night when he was sleeping at his own home with his children and family, and all his family were killed. This can give an idea about how bad the situation was, and it's a crime. You cannot call it other than that.
So going forward, Dr. Abu Hadrous, especially with the blockade on Gaza, how can the international community support and help rebuild Gaza's healthcare system? What has to happen?
Yeah, it's a difficult situation. We are trying to manage. We are doing our best, you know. But I think the only solution to our problem is ending the occupation. By ending the occupation, you know, I think each side will get peace and each side can develop normally.
Dr. Nidal Abu Hadrous is head of the neurosurgery department at the European Hospital in Gaza. He witnessed and worked through the fighting there at the hospital to treat the wounded. Dr. Abu Hadrous, thank you very much for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Finding a solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict starts with naming the problem. There's one word that seems to be gaining traction. Apartheid has been used to describe Israel's control over the Palestinians. This is not a new thing, but the accusation now seems to be making its way into the mainstream. The global advocacy group Human Rights Watch recently accused Israel of persecution and apartheid. The World's Sarah Birnbaum has our story.
Apartheid is not a charge Eric Goldstein takes lightly. Goldstein edited the Human Rights Watch report that used the A word.
I think that 20 years ago, we would not have called the situation apartheid.
Back then, the Oslo peace process was in full swing.
And we, I think, like many people, thought that perhaps soon there would be two states. And so whatever abuses that were occurring in the occupied territories, however bad they might have been, it looked like a temporary situation. And there were Israeli leaders who could say with a straight face, we don't intend to rule over the Palestinians in the occupied territories forever.
After 54 years of occupation, Goldstein says the situation feels very far from temporary. The problem is most glaring in the West Bank, where everyone lives under the same Israeli authority, but Jewish Israelis have full political and legal rights, while Palestinians do not. Goldstein says this is a version of apartheid.
We're not using apartheid like flamethrowers. We're not using it as an insult word. It is a term meant to refer to a particularly severe type of systematized discrimination.
The word apartheid originated in South Africa. It was the racist political system that governed every aspect of life from 1948 to 1991. But in the past 20 years, the term has become much broader. According to the International Criminal Court, apartheid is a system of legalized racial discrimination in which one racial group is deprived of political and civil rights. But the word is still so loaded that many experts won't go near it, and nor should they, says veteran journalist Hirsch Goodman.
Apartheid is a sacred word. It is not to be used lightly.
Goodman grew up in South Africa and immigrated to Israel in 1965 as a teenager. He says the people who use apartheid to describe Israel are usually activists who want to present an ugly caricature of the Jewish state and undermine its right to exist.
For me, the word apartheid, having grown up with it, no free press, no free thought, arrest without trial, like Stasi police, 2 million whites subjecting 20 million blacks, moving populations from rich farmland to Bantustans, a system that is so horrible that I can't even begin to see the comparison.
But many South Africans do see the comparison, including the president, Cyril Ramaphosa, who was an anti-apartheid activist. In an interview with France 24, Ramaphosa said the plight of the Palestinians triggered a horrible sense of deja vu.
The images that we've been seeing of people being prevented to move around, of their homes being destroyed, brings back very terrible memories of our own history and apartheid.
A younger generation of South Africans also sees parallels. Mohamed Desai is with a group called Africa for Palestine. He was 5 when apartheid ended in 1991, and in 2004, he took a gap year in Israel. He said he had to go through the military checkpoint between the West Bank and Jerusalem quite a lot.
One experience that sort of was very jarring was when crossing the Kalandia checkpoint and I hand over my passport and the soldier who greets me sees that the passport is South African and starts speaking to me in Afrikaans.
Desai says here was an Israeli soldier demanding his identification papers, speaking the same language as the authorities back home who caused Desai's family so much pain.
That was a stark reminder of the apartheid South African regime and of Israel's own complicity with apartheid South Africa.
Israel became a friend of the South African apartheid regime in the 1970s, and it was one of the last Western nations to sever ties with the country after global sanctions were imposed in the late 80s. On the flip side, Nelson Mandela and Yasser Arafat were friends. Arafat was the chairman of the PLO, the Palestine Liberation Organization, which provided military support to the African National Congress in the 1970s. And that's why, Desai says, today, many Black South Africans identify with the Palestinians and are active in the anti-Israel boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, which incidentally has been organizing Israel Apartheid Week on college campuses since 2005.
Long before it was fashionable, long before it was attractive or sexy, it was the Palestinians who gave us financial resources, they gave us military training, they gave us various other forms of solidarity. So in some ways, it's paying back for that.
The debate over the A word isn't just about rhetoric. It's about consequences.
Whether you call the situation apartheid, occupation, or conflict will determine the particular roles and responsibilities of those involved.
Leonie Fleischmann teaches international politics at City University of London.
When it's defined as the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, it's a case of two equal sides who need to come together on a negotiation table in order to resolve the conflict.
That's the framework used in the 90s with the Oslo peace process. Now, Fleischmann says, the international community calls Israel's controls over Gaza, the West Bank, and East Jerusalem a military occupation. Fleischmann says under this framework, the occupier, Israel, has certain obligations toward the occupied people, the Palestinians. But at the same time, Israel can legally take its security into account.
So they could argue, for example, that something that we're doing, yes, it may be an abuse of rights, but it's necessary in order to protect the security of Israelis. But as soon as you start talking about the situation in terms of apartheid, that idea of balancing interest is no longer applicable.
Apartheid is defined as a crime against humanity under international law.
We have a case where a certain group are privileged over another group, and there's a clear oppressor and oppressed, such that those who are oppressed need to be freed from this oppression.
When groups like Human Rights Watch use the term apartheid, it's strategic. They're emphasizing the need for a paradigm shift when it comes to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Eric Goldstein of Human Rights Watch says he wants the international community to talk less about one state or two and more about how to secure equal rights for everyone between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean Sea.
Let's move away from the illusion that human rights abuses are the unfortunate symptom of no resolution to the conflict and that it's best to reach a solution and then the rights will all fall into place. Let's start with giving everybody their rights and then we can all work for a resolution to the outstanding political issues.
Goldstein hopes that's a vision most people can get behind, whether they use the word apartheid or not. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
When it comes to Russia, there's a tendency to talk about the opposition to President Vladimir Putin as if it is one man, Alexei Navalny, and his movement. But Navalny is in jail, and not a week goes by without the arrests of more activists and independent journalists. Even as speaking out has become increasingly dangerous, a young Russian artist is using her work to make sure anti-Kremlin voices keep getting heard. From Moscow, reporter Theo Mertz has a story.
Vinzavod is a former wine factory in the center of Moscow. The factory's been converted into a space for contemporary art, cafes and shops. It's a beautiful early summer day and there's a young crowd here. But the mood changes when you walk into an exhibition by Katya Muromtseva. You're immediately struck by the huge mural that covers three of the high white walls. The mural looks as if it's been scribbled with a giant pen. You can make out the shapes of riot police and protesters. On the fourth wall, there's a blood-red painting covered with similar looping black lines.
It's not comfortable, of course. I mean, time when we are living, when we leave. It's not comfortable, so...
Protests are a familiar sight in Moscow. Tens of thousands of people have taken to the streets this year, calling for the release of opposition leader Alexei Navalny. Beneath the wall art, there are five screens with text silently rolling across.
All of this show is based on the interviews that I made with people from my generations.
She's recorded their political awakenings, and now their stories are displayed on the video screens. One person she interviewed volunteered to work as an election monitor, only to see ballot boxes being stuffed. Another, a student who began travelling around Europe in 2014 and witnessed the outrage there over Russia's annexation of Crimea. A third interview is with a man who used to sneak away from his wife at night to graffiti anti-Kremlin slogans around the city.
A lot of people think that, okay, we cannot change anything, this is the government, they have power and blah, blah, blah. But that's not true.
Muromtseva is 31 and she's part of a generation that is causing concern for the Kremlin. They're more opposed to Putin than the generation above them. They also tend to get their news online rather than from tightly controlled state media.
How can we trust the news? Because it's like the point where all the news are written by the state.
Authorities are now forcing independent news sites out of business. That's part of the reason why Muromtseva wanted to collect these stories.
So for me, this is the new version of the news, how it can be written. It can be written only by this very particular, very individual, emotional stories.
Muromtseva describes herself as a socially engaged artist rather than a political one. This animated video with an ambient soundtrack is an example of her past work. It's based on interviews with children about how they imagine life was like in the Soviet Union. She's also worked with old people to redecorate retirement homes. Muromtseva is far from the only Russian artist who deals with political themes, but this combination of art, social engagement and journalism is unusual. It's also potentially dangerous. In recent months, authorities have arrested members of Pussy Riot, the performance art group. Police have shut down shows by an independent theatre troupe called Teatr Dok. And another young artist in the far east of Russia, Yulia Tsvetkova, is facing ongoing criminal charges because of her work. I asked Muromtseva if she was worried for herself.
Actually, everybody asked this question during my exhibition opening because all of these stories, they're very openly, they have this open critique of the state.
She doesn't imagine she will have problems. She doesn't see herself as a provocateur, but she understands the concern. It is a hard time for artists.
But on the other hand, I think this is very fruitful for artists to have this kind of tension because your voice really matter, I think.
Not everyone shares Muromtseva's upbeat outlook.
I don't see future in the way that probably Katya sees.
This is Sergei Khrypun, the co-owner of XL Gallery, where the exhibition is running until the middle of the month. He's a generation older than the artist. He's seen many protest movements before, including the one that brought down the Soviet Union 30 years ago. Khrypun admires moments of his art, but he's critical of the interviews.
They're quite naive. I would say.
I don't agree.
Well, I mean, I feel them. Well, I see that these are young people, and this is a naive thing. It's their hopes, it's their frustrations, whatever. Well, let's see if you consider asking them 5 or 10 years later.
But Muharrem Sever is convinced that real change can come. She recently worked with Russian teenagers, which gave her hope.
They're like so open and fearless, and they're very politically engaged, and they really aware what's going on in our country. And they are the future, and we are the future.
Russia is holding parliamentary elections in the fall, which the ruling United Russia Party is all but certain to win, despite its falling popularity. With the opposition forced out of politics, it remains to be seen how Muramsev's fearless generation will make itself heard. For The World, I'm Theo Mertz in Moscow.
Vice President Kamala Harris wrapped up her first international trip today. She was visiting leaders in Guatemala and Mexico. At the top of the agenda, the root causes of migration to the U.S. southern border. The World's immigration editor, Monica Campbell, has been following all of this. Monica, what can we say at this point about this first visit to the region by Vice President Harris?
It's the start of a very complicated challenge. I mean, the administration is saying it's going to commit billions of dollars to tackle the root causes of why people leave their homes in Central America. And in Guatemala, Vice President Harris met with political and civil society leaders, which is important to underline because they're trying to break up some of the molds. They're not just speaking with government officials, but she was also speaking with people who work in philanthropy and in the private sector in Guatemala. There's a lot of skepticism whether this will be enough. We've seen U.S. aid delivered to parts of Central America for years. At the same time, we have also seen migration and poverty in Central America move up despite that foreign aid. So there's a lot of skepticism about whether foreign aid is the correct tool to change realities on the ground enough to convince people to remain at home and not go to the United States.
And today, Harris was in Mexico to meet with President Andrés Manuel López Obrador. Migration was also on the agenda there too, right?
Absolutely. Mexico is a critical partner in all of this. And Harris said today that Mexico and the U.S. are, quote, embarking on a new era. And they might be. The former Trump administration threatened Mexico with tariffs if it didn't work with the U.S. on migration. The Biden administration isn't using that blunt language with Mexico. And Mexico's president has deployed thousands of National Guard officers to its southern border with Guatemala. Mexico is also deporting many migrants. And we'll see if this visit results in stepped up enforcement from within Mexico on migration. But there are really strong competing forces here. Many migrants pay thousands of dollars to migrate through Mexico and across the U.S. border. I've spoken to many migrants who've witnessed how those thousands of dollars trickle down along the way, with criminal groups in Mexico paying off officials there, police, and of course we see U.S. border officials implicated in human smuggling. These are transnational criminal operations that are tough to dismantle.
In addition to her conversations with leaders in Mexico and Guatemala, Vice President Harris also gave a clear message to migrants who might consider traveling to the U.S.-Mexico border.
Do not come. Do not come. The United States will continue to enforce our laws and secure our border.
Monica, how do you break down what seems like a very simple message?
Well, the administration is hoping to deter people from arriving to the U.S.-Mexico border, which we have seen people doing in large numbers over the past several months. We're also seeing that that message isn't working. Telling people to not come is not proving to be a deterrent. People are arriving, and despite laws at the U.S.-Mexico border and policies that are really making it hard for people to try and claim asylum at the U.S.-Mexico border, something we've reported on quite a bit, people are finding a way in, perhaps by far more dangerous routes. So the deterrence message is not convincing, at least people I've spoken to who are prepping to leave Central America or who have arrived recently. They're not referencing that message. What they're referencing, people arriving today in the United States, crossing the border, they're referencing the need to be able to feed their families back home. And they see jobs here in the United States opening back up again, restaurants opening back up again. That's the reality that they're seeing. Vice President Harris's message isn't landing strongly enough to convince them to stay.
The Biden administration, Monica, also created a task force to work on the families separated at the border during former President Trump's so-called zero-tolerance policy. That task force came out with its first report today. What's new in it?
Biden officials are reporting more than 2,100 children separated from their parents at the border by Trump's policy have yet to be reunited. Only about 7 children have been reunited with their families since Biden took office. It's very slow, hard work. It means people on the ground in parts of Central America going to these remote areas of the region to find parents who were deported without their children, and it could take years to have more families be together again.
The World's immigration editor, Monica Campbell, summing up Vice President Harris's trip to Guatemala and Mexico. Thanks for chatting, Monica.
You're welcome.
Today, June the 8th, is World Oceans Day. The UN established the day to remind us of our own human impact on the world's oceans. Remember that water covers more than 70% of the planet. We humans owe a lot to that water. So a Cuban musician has paid tribute to the seas.
My name is Gillian Cañizares.
And Gillian is here to tell us about her new song, Jemaya.
The song you're hearing right now is my tribute to the West African goddess of the sea, Jemaya. Jemaya symbolizes the Mother Earth, and is represented by the colors blue and white as the water, as the ocean. I have projected the image of Jemaya, of the goddess of the sea, as a healing force that will unite humanity. Also, as I was born and raised in Cuba, I have a very deep connection with water. And we Cubans, we have a strong symbolism and a sacred dimension of water as a part of our daily life. Como el mar quieto es la conciencia, como una ola mi existencia. En el respeto está la esencia, y del amor viene mi fuerza. I decided to release the song today, World Ocean Day, and it's very important for me to put my art and my music at the service of the crisis that the oceans are facing. Soñé de plástico, petróleo, residuo tóxico en el agua. Soñé de peces que se asfixian, de nuestro mar que se secaba. Y vi los brazos de mi madre, vi a Yemayá que me llamaba. I felt naturally very inspired to write this piece and to be the voice of the ocean, because I ask myself this question: if the sea could send a message to humanity, what would it be? So today is a very important day, a day to celebrate, to take action for our shared ocean. It's also a day that I hope we will connect through music and through joy with a million of other people around our planet. And it's a new start for me for creating a better future together.
That's Cuban musician Gillian Cañizares telling us about her new song, Jemaya, a song to celebrate the seas on this World Oceans Day. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Stay cool, be safe, and dive in. The water's great. We'll see you back here tomorrow.